You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. These podcasts explore the future of food and nutrition, featuring the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries from across the food industry who are going to change our world. We like to dig deep and question everything that we think we know about food and drink. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Now, in this edition, we're exploring the history of one of my favourite drinks. I start the day with a pint of rooibos tea before moving on to a waterfall of coffee. Then in the afternoon, around 3 o'clock or so, I'm back on the Earl Grey. Then late afternoon, have a dainty little pot of jasmine tea before diving into an evening of alcohol-free spirits and beer. Well, it is January currently, but it does seem as though tea is constantly being rediscovered by the food and drink industry. It's cropping up as a functional and flavouring ingredient in all sorts of places, from yoghurt to cocktails. Now, to help us understand the past of this incredible drink and ask what historical secrets today's tea industry should be exploring, we're joined by Will Battle, Managing Director at Fine Tea Merchants and author of the World Tea Encyclopedia. Welcome, Will. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Stefan. Thanks for having me on.
Ah, it's so exciting. Now, the history of tea must be part of the big histories of the world. So I'm really excited by this. Now, but first of all, let's take a snapshot of the industry at the moment. How big an industry is tea in the present day? Why does it appear to be catching the imagination of the food industry at the moment as well?
It's certainly big. It's the most consumed product and beverage in the world after water. So it's definitely really significant. One of the things that makes it so significant is it's the favourite drink of the Chinese and the Indians as well.
Yeah. So we got numbers there, haven't we? We got numbers of people.
Weight of numbers. But also what tea does really well, and I will not be disparaging about my coffee colleagues, but tea can react and respond to trends very much more effectively than coffee can. Because it's a leaf, and if you view tea in a slightly broader sense and you add all the botanicals that are drunk as tea as well, you can really react to trends that are in the food market space. So an example of that might be, say, gin and tonic. It really seems to have grown in popularity over the last decade. And what a tea brand can do is, firstly, you can put out a tea blend that has a gin and tonic taste. So you might put juniper berries in it or any other sort of botanical that you might also find in gin. I've also seen teas brewed and then frozen as ice cubes to include as the ice in G&T.
Oh, I like that.
And then you've got tea used as one of the botanicals in the gin making process. And there's quite a few gins now that have tea in. So that's just one trend, but tea features in it at numerous levels and in numerous ways. And I think that's one of the great beauties of tea, is it's got this massive versatility.
Yeah, and I guess also, I mean, just to be unromantic about it, it's shelf stable. You know, it's an organic product. It's harvested, but once it's been dried out, you know, it can be shipped around the world very easily. It can be stored for a fair amount of time on a shelf, and so you know, it helps. You know, it's a useful tool for businesses to make money as well. And I guess money is at the heart of the history of tea as well. Take us right back to the origins of tea. How much do we know about the discovery of tea? And how it evolved.
One of the things you learn when you get into the tea industry is particularly on Chinese teas, and tea's origins lie in really in those borderlands, China, Laos, Myanmar, the sort of jungle areas there. One of the things that you learn is there's a lot of myth. And it's difficult to divorce the myth from the fact. So the myth is that in 2437 BC, Emperor Shennong was reclining next to his cauldron and a leaf fell from a tree, which was what we now know as the tea bush, Camellia sinensis, and it fell into his cauldron and he thought that smells or tastes quite nice and he got stuck in. That's the myth, and I think that's it's a lovely story. But I think if you you go to those areas, I mean, there's a long tradition of herbalists trying to identify plants which are either medicinal or tasty or combination of those things. And Shennong, for example, is credited with a whole load of inventions It may be that tea was one of them. The hoe, the plow, the axe, the farmer's market, harvest festival, all of those things he's sort of credited with responsibility for.
But that's a pretty good roster, actually, I'd say.
You know, it's not bad on your CV, is it?
Yeah.
But I think probably, you know, there's some elements of truth to it, and it doesn't really matter, really. I think what's important is that tea really started to become popular in China from sort of 300 AD onwards. And there were a couple of things that really helped to give tea a step up. Publication of a book by an author called Lu Yu, who really told us how it should be drunk, how it should be prepared, what sort of water should be used with it. And those sort of things, those learnings, really helped people understand how to take this leaf and turn it into something that really actually does taste good when you brew it. So there's a few things that happened after that discovery moment that really took tea from a niche herbal remedy, perhaps, into mainstream beverage.
So what's intriguing for me is why? Why do humans have this need to flavour their water? What's the psychology behind it, do you think? Because, you know, you could just drink water. You could even just drink hot water. Is it about making something fascinating? Does it sort of hark back to, you know, the first pineapple arriving in Britain and people showing off to each other because they can create something? Is it real, or is it a world that has been built out of human need to sort of compete with each other for fanciness or to create a new sort of system around which they can be the top of the tree?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head with the fact that it does make hot water taste a lot nicer, a lot more palatable. You know, hot water, which a lot of people needed to boil for sanitary reasons, lukewarm water is not a very easy way to rehydrate yourself always. It's nicer if it tastes good. I think also with tea, there's that sort of lovely combination of stimulus and relaxation that you get.
Yeah.
That is another factor that's quite apart from the taste. So it's helping people often go about their daily lives because of its, you know, the other things that happen when you drink a cup of tea. So perhaps that's another factor that's not just taste.
And would you say that caffeine content or you know, any particular psychoactive aspects of tea have been important in its success?
Yeah, I think they have. That is a factor, probably not the chief factor necessarily, but I think that is a factor. But probably as much the caffeine combined with the sort of L-theanine, where you get this nice, you're not turbocharged and sort of wide-eyed. You've got a sort of a level of balance. And I think that's the nice thing about tea.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to set the stage for us, what defines tea? Because you could chuck a load of anything into some water and get something that tastes of something different than the water. Is there a particular definition of a tea? Is it you know, using a specific type of leaf, or can we just throw the doors wide open and embrace anything as being the source of tea?
Well, no, I would be quite strict with my definition of tea. It doesn't mean that we can't enjoy those other botanicals, which I would group into the classification of herbal infusions or infusions, or fruit infusions, depending upon exactly what's in the recipe. But I would really be quite clear that tea is from Camellia sinensis plant.
It's that particular leaf. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think, and there's no problem referring to a, in my mind, there's no problem referring to a herbal infusion as a herbal tea. I don't think we need to get overly caught up in that, really. Perhaps the lawyers do when you're looking at back of pack text.
Yes, but, absolutely.
I don't think it's something that we need to worry too much about. It's Camellia sinensis, though, is really what I would class as tea. That evergreen bush that grows in the tropical and subtropical parts of the world. It's maintained at sort of waist height so that you can, oh, there's a few exceptions to this, which is quite interesting. It's maintained at waist height so you can pluck it easily and it looks beautiful.
Well, that's really interesting because I in a former life, I was in film production and we filmed a feature film at somewhere called Uttarakhand, which is in Tamil Nadu in India. And it was a very, very beautiful tea-growing region. It's an old colonial state. conversation. And you drive around that area, and it's just stunning, absolutely beautiful. And yet, when you see the people who are picking the tea, you wonder if this beauty, if it hides human discomfort, human misery, you know, from the British being a colonial power, you know, planting tea out in the countryside. It's been about money, and money had, you know, in the past has been the source of misery for some people, but also the source of advancement for others. So just again, to strip away the romance of everything that you're talking about and to bring it down to the cash and the industry, how important has tea been to the economy of the world?
Yeah, it's definitely a factor in bringing a source of employment to parts of the world that don't have many other potential revenue sources. I think that's probably one of the first things to state. So if you take the tea bush, it needs about 1.1 meters of rain to flourish. That means that typically you need to grow it in mountainous areas where you tend to get more rainfall.
Yeah.
And those mountainous areas are often quite remote, and there's not much other employment opportunity there. So I think it does bring revenue to the more remote parts of the world. Mm. And I think now, if you look at, you know, every industry will have its laggards and its more progressive businesses. And I think, you know, your trip to Ooty, you will have seen some, actually in Ooty, you're in one of the most educationally advanced parts of India, in that you're not very far from the tech hubs of Bangalore and Hyderabad, Tamil Nadu and Kerala, that part of India, which are the most literate states in India. And I think you've got actually quite good educational opportunities down there. And I think you'll find companies there that are very advanced and trying to work very hard for the people who they employ. And actually that part of India, probably as big a problem is getting people who will work in tea, because there are so many other opportunities.
Yeah.
But I'd say perhaps if you cycle back, tea is often one of the few opportunities to earn in more remote parts of the world.
And in terms of the development of economies generally, the Chinese economy, Russian, Mongolian, Japanese, has it been a kind of a key part of the way that those economies have developed?
Yes, certainly. A key export commodity, certainly China, and perhaps to a greater extent, parts of the world like Sri Lanka. At the moment, Sri Lanka is in desperate need for foreign exchange.
Yeah.
Really desperate need for foreign exchange. Real struggle at the moment. Tea is absolutely vital to that country. So, yeah, I mean, it has been a key part of the economic growth story of some of those countries. I mean, I think in China now it's way eclipsed by everything else. I'm not sure if President Xi would even recognise tea on the statistics necessarily when you look at everything else that's coming out of China. But it still occupies quite a significant part in the story of the country. So when, for example, when Prime Minister Theresa May met President Xi, she was served a particular type of tea, of course, tea called a Fu tea. And, you know, still, even though President Xi probably wasn't all that keen in boosting his tea exports, it was still important to him to serve her tea because it's such an important part of that Chinese heritage.
And it's always had some sense of value. I mean, is it true that it has been used as a currency in the past?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you've got times when there was quite a strong barter trade in the borderlands of that China, Siberia, Mongolia sort of area. Often you'd find furs from Russia exchanged for tea bricks from China.
Yeah.
And tea bricks are sort of essentially compressed tea, which makes it quite easy to transport them on caravans, camel caravans. And we talk about tea being used as a currency, and often there's tea bricks where you can, a bit like bars of chocolate, where you can break off chunks and then you can therefore break it down into sort of loose change in a way. So yes, it has been used as a currency, but it's probably better viewed as a sort of a barter trade.
And in terms of the impact of it, in, you know, I know that the Boston Tea Party, you know, the American Revolution wasn't about tea, but it encapsulated the concept of taxation for the Americans. Have there been wars? Have there been tea riots in the way that there have been bread riots?
Yeah, there have been. I think probably a bigger factor has been smuggling as a consequence of duty. Mm. The Boston Tea Party is, we know it as a sort of essentially a rejection of the London imposed duties on tea. Mm. But over here, tea duty, up until Prime Minister Pitt the Younger, tea duty was at 119%. And there was enormous smuggling. And that created, you know, real lawlessness. There was a famous gang called the Hawkhurst Gang, who essentially laid waste to vast areas of Sussex because of their attempt to sort of impose a gangland ownership of particular domains where they could bring their smuggled tea in. And I think that was a real factor. And actually, when Pitt removed tea duty and he replaced it, interestingly, with window tax, and you see all these bricked up windows around the country, that was what made up the revenue for the removal of tea duty. That was the thing, really, coupled with a slight increase in supply. But the removal of tea duty sort of really brought tea much more into the mainstream. But in a way, smuggling of tea actually did help tea go from aristocratic preserve to a more mass beverage, because it did make it more accessible to the masses. And it was quite wide. You know, a lot of tea in those days, in those late 18th century days, was drunk from smuggled stock.
Yeah. And in terms, now you're a tea merchant. First of all, I'm fascinated by that, and I'd love to know what you do on a typical day. Is it about weighing up costs? Is it about tasting? Do you do cupping with tea in the same way that you do with coffee? What are the most exciting parts of your job?
Tasting's one of them, definitely. And particularly, some of the more exciting teas are seasonal teas that you'd get. I mean, seasonality creates interest and variation. Yep. Although tea is an evergreen plant, in where it's the more extremes of the tropics, it goes into dormancy in winter. So when it awakens from dormancy, you get the start of a new season. Say somewhere like Darjeeling, we hear of Darjeeling first flush. That's the first growth of the year. And tasting those teas, you know, when you get to March time and you start getting the first samples through from Darjeeling, and that is one of the most interesting parts of the job, is tasting perhaps 100, 200 different batches of tea in a day to try and work out which ones will be most suitable for my customers or my would-be customers. Really rigorous analysis of aroma, colour in the cup, taste.
And do you ever use mass spectrometry and gas chromatography, or is it all in the mouth and in the perception of the human?
We don't use it, because most of our clients are looking for tea to drink as a, you know, as a sort of brewed in the traditional fashion. Yeah. Mass spectrometry and gas chromatography are used for various other applications. You might be making wanting to extract for iced tea or something like that. So that's where you might find more use of more complex analysis tools. But we, you know, we're looking at leaf, we're smelling leaf, we're doing a lot of tasting, and that is a large part of the job, but also just talking to people. It's still quite a word of mouth industry, building up relationships and making sure that you know the growers who are going to make the sort of tea that your clients are going to be interested in. And this is very much built on relationships. There's quite a lot of investment in that as well.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a set of questions which you would have been asked a million times before, but they have to be asked right here and now. What's your favourite tea?
Darjeeling First Flush.
How do you drink it?
I drink it without milk, and I drink it I probably drink 12 to 15 cups a day.
Wow, that's quite a lot. Okay, and without, do you think we should all be drinking without milk, or is it a broad church and you enjoy it however you want it?
No. Drink it how you want. And when I wake up in the morning, I'll drink a strong traditional English breakfast tea with milk, and I love it. I think it's, you can enjoy multiple types of tea across the day, and there's no reason why you shouldn't enjoy tea with milk or with sugar. Enjoy it how you like.
Yeah. Have you ever drunk a cup of tea that has made you cry with joy?
No, I'm not that sort of a person, Steph. Although, in reverse, it is the cup of tea to give someone who is crying. It is the thing to give someone who is crying to cheer them up.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. All right. I'll take that. What's the most expensive tea in the world? And is it worth it in your opinion?
So there's a few different answers for this because it's just been an auction in Hong Kong, I think, where teas have been sold for enormous sums of money. So the most valuable tea, traditionally the story is that there's a tea called Da Hong Pao, which is from one of three bushes halfway up a cliff somewhere in a remote part of China. And you can look up in the story in more detail. But Nixon, when he visited China, was presented with a very small parcel of this tea. And he had bought Mao a limo. Mao gave him a little bit of this tea. I think Nixon's famous, you know, not quite a prickly character, was a bit nonplussed by it. But you know, Mao's gift was probably worth more than his limo was.
Brilliant.
So, you know, is it worth it? And it's all in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?
It's in the story and the romance, isn't it? I just want to break into the conversation here to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another of our History Of podcasts. It's called The History Behind Your Christmas Dinner and features respected food historian Saren Charrington-Hollins. You can search for it on our website at foodmatterslive.com. Now, back to the chat. I just chug tea. I don't. But if you would advise me to find a way to really enjoy it, to go on one of your journeys of experimentation and tasting things, what is the best way to drink tea? Is it super hot? Is it actually at sort of 70 degrees when it's calmed down a little? What's the best way to taste a fine tea?
I think it depends on the tea. My overall philosophy is that don't get overly caught up in the snob factor of it. So just sort of take a slightly skeptical view of all of the sort of advice. And if there's a couple of things to remember, good water. So the first thing I'd say is, particularly if you live on a sort of a line south and east of from the Humber to the Bristol Channel, then the water might not be great to you. It's quite hard.
Yeah,
there's parts of Swindon that have terribly hard water. And, you know, you've got to, so a Brita filter or something like that. So good water. Mm-hmm. And then also good tea. Now, the difference between a really good tea bag and an average one, you know, you can get a really good tea bag from the supermarket shelf at 5p. And an average one might be 1.5, 2p. So, you know, it is possible to get a really good cup of tea for not much outlay. And I'd say also then experimenting with different green and black teas. Green teas, typically, really, you don't need to use boiling water because you're not looking for the same things in the final product as you are with a black tea. So with black tea, you're looking to extract, you know, as much as you can. You get those sort of bitter notes and you want the balance between the different elements of the cup. Whereas with green tea, you're looking for more of the sweetness.
Mm. And you can easily make it bitter by having the water too hot.
Yes. So, and particularly really good Japanese teas, you might only need to do it at 70 degrees. Perhaps boil the kettle and then leave it a few minutes and then pour out.
Okay, well, you talked about the sort of the snobbery, but let's dive into that a little bit because it's quite fun. Let's talk a little bit about rituals. I have been I've been shown the tea ceremony in Japan, and it's sort of beautiful and painful at the same time. But ceremony there has always been a ritual element to drinking tea in some situations, hasn't there?
Yes, definitely. And I'm with you on Japanese tea ceremonies. It's one of the great experiences of tea is participation. Well, I'm useless at crossing my legs, so I find it
same here. It's absolutely same here.
Yeah, so yeah, get quite painful. But it's there's always been an element of ritual, and actually, there's some beautiful. It's where tea, it's where sort of beverage preparation meets theatre, and it's also interesting that in we know the Japanese ceremony, but lots of Chinese provinces have their own ceremonies as well, which are beautiful to watch. Really is a joy to see. And there's a point to all of it. Each individually sort of choreographed move in the ceremony has a reason. But if there's one thing I always take away from it, it's the respect that East Asian cultures have for this amazing product. Mm. And we've got our own rituals over here, but it's also about really respecting the product, I think. You know, for me, one of my rituals, I'll get up, I'll fill my water filter, I'll let it trickle through, boiling the kettle. You know, it gives you a moment to take some time out of your day and just have some me time. I think that's one of the things that sort of gives you a moment just to do something else. And if you have 16 cups like I do, you're punctuating your day more often than everyone else is.
This is a tool, isn't it? I know what you're doing with this. Okay, let's go back to the historical aspect to it. The European history tea is sort of based around class. You know, there's obviously the colonial aspect. It's enriched the upper classes. Did it begin as a drink for the elite and then change? And you were talking about smuggling, sort of changing the nature of how people drank it. Does it have the same sort of aspects to it as coffee did, where there were coffee houses in London that became important sort of centres for thought and politics?
I think perhaps less so in terms of thought and politics, but perhaps fashion is something that you can think of. Catherine Braganza, who's known as the person who really first popularised tea, she's perhaps the first influencer. And, you know, nowadays we're very familiar with that term, but it's very much been around, it's been with us for a long time. When the Queen is drinking tea and it filters down through the aristocracy and it's seen as the thing to do. I think that is how it became really popularized. It's that fashion for trying to do what, you know, something aspirational.
Yeah.
And that's the initial sort of real growth in tea in the upper classes, I think, is to my mind, is more about fashion and the rise of the influencer.
Yeah. And in terms of sort of fashion today, what is it? What are the tools that people are clinging on to in order to market their teas? What is it, this sort of the concept, you know, the French wine concept of terroir? You know, this is where it grows here, and my hill slopes to the west. And then obviously the person down the road will say, yes, it's because my hill slopes to the east. And it's all, frankly, a little bit of BS. But so what are the stories that people tell about their teas, and which ones do you think really resonate?
I think the good thing about tea is that you can go in a load of different directions with it. There's room for the terroiriste in tea, definitely. And then perhaps grouped with that is the artisan. You know, I'll give you an example. There's a lovely little factory in South India called the Tea Studio. And the Tea Studio they don't own their own tea land. They buy leaf from local communities and they only employ women. And they will make all their teas by hand. And that is about training and empowering local women to create really genuinely world-leading artisanal products. And the people who said that is the artisanal side of it. And there'll be a lot of people around the world, Canada, USA, UK, Western Europe, where that sort of thing, where you really play on the artisanal skill in the tea maker, that's quite of the moment.
Yeah.
Terroir is also a key factor. And I think Darjeeling, for example, is for me, it's a classic example of how the elements of terroir that we understand from wine also apply in tea. And you've got, perhaps apply even more so, because you've got these very cold winters, cold winds coursing down from the Himalayas, bush goes into dormancy. And then when it awakens in March, you've got these amazing tastes in tea that come through. And we've seen those tastes applied really creatively in tea, but also in kombucha and in, you know, load of sort of areas where you can really play on the local aspects of what was happening when the tea was grown. So I think artisanal and terroir are big factors, but also the brands. You know, there's a lot in almost the other end of the scale in delivering to your consumers exactly what you've delivered to them for 200 years. And I think there's elements of that as well, which is almost the other end of the scale. But I don't think any of them are right or wrong, but they've all having elements of their success.
Yeah. So there are lots of different ways to succeed with it, I suppose. But what about the other aspects of it, sort of different ways of serving it, you know, pickled tea leaves, tea and salads, smoking your salmon using Earl Grey leaves, sparkling teas, things like that. Give us a little overview of the other aspects to it, the other sort of technical sides to it and the other products that are cropping up.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably chief amongst them at the moment is, I'd say, kombucha, just because it's that place where tea, the old traditional cozy world of tea, meets the hipster beard craft beer industry.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's a great thing to explore. I think so that will be one area at the moment where I see enormous opportunity, particularly also the growth in the no and low alcohol movement. Mm-hmm. That is probably the most exciting area at the moment, I'd say. And I group sparkling tea to an extent into that.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned tea pickled and salads. Yes, if you've been to Myanmar, then you've seen this delicacy where you an enormous amount of tea. Look at the statistics in Myanmar. An enormous amount of tea is grown, but not very much tea is drunk. And that is because it's eaten. Mm. And it's like students in Myanmar will eat this product called, I might not be pronouncing it right, La Fette. And it's a bit like what I used to have before I was revising for my exams. I used to have Pro Plus or something like that to keep me going through the night. And a plate of this, because you're eating it, really does give you a kick and keeps you revising all night long. And that is also, you know, a really interesting area to explore, tea as food. Those are completely opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you've also got, what I like about tea is this variety and opportunity, iced teas. You know, we think of iced teas as being the things in cans out of the chiller cabinet, but there's all sorts of other ways of making iced tea that can really keep tea going through the summer months. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there, particularly out of home in restaurants and cafes. Creative ways of serving tea in the summer I find really interesting. And I'll also group botanical infusions in that. Hibiscus works really well in the summer over ice.
And I think with if you need to compete with coffee, the coffee aspect is the fact that somebody has to do a sequence of events to create a coffee. And I think that's why I'm happy to pay a ridiculous amount of money sometimes for a coffee. Tea, if it's just somebody putting a tea bag in a cup, I simply don't see the craft going into it. And with these things that you're mentioning, once there are other elements to it and there's some way of crafting the tea rather than just dunking the tea bag, then I'm a buyer. Then I'm thinking, okay, I got to show how shallow I am, I know. But then suddenly I'm willing to pay a little bit more money for it because I understand that some thought has gone into it. There's a process. And do you think that's important to the future of tea and the future of the commerce of tea?
I think it's important to the future of out-of-home tea, yes, showing that you're trying to deliver a little bit more value. Yeah, I think it is. Even if it's showing the temperature, you know, you've understood the temperature at which you should brew it, or you've understood that the water has to be right for the tea, particularly green teas. I think elements like that are important if you're going to charge a premium for it, because one of the challenges everyone knows is that you can buy the same thing in the supermarket often for a lot less. Yeah. So they've really got to show that some creative flair has gone into its preparation.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about the functional elements of tea as a sort of nutritional tool and people mentioning aspects like immunity and brain health, aging, digestion. Do you think that this is a continuation of how it's been viewed through history, or is it a new thing? And do you think it's a little bit of a con, or is there some decent enough science for you to be able to market teas based on these ideas?
It's definitely a continuation. I mean, the first mentions of tea back in the 17th century were as a medicinal drink. So, yeah, it's a continuation. But equally, I think even when it was mentioned as a medicinal drink back in the 17th century, a lot of that was people who grew tea or who were importing it, trying to say, yeah, it'll do you some good as well.
Marketing.
So there's marketing even in those days. And I think the reason to drink tea now should be because you like it. There's a lot of science, and I think it's justified science. A lot of science to say that tea will do you good in a whole raft of different functional areas. Mm. But really, the reason to drink tea should be because you like it, because there's all sorts of other healthy things you can drink as well. Yeah. Teas, but really, if you're only drinking it because you want functional benefit, then I think life's too short, perhaps, to make that your only, yeah, your only thing, you know, to be preoccupied with. I would say that but there is a lot of evidence. There's a new paper every week comes out. But I do think drink tea because you like it. And there's enough tea in the world. There's such the variety of taste opportunities in tea is big enough that there is a tea for everybody. It really is.
I have to say, the more you talk about it, the more I just want to dive. I'm drinking a cup of coffee at the moment, I have to say. The more I want to dive back into the kitchen and just dig out all of those teas that I've been given for Christmas and start exploring. Now, history and heritage have been a big part of marketing. We talked a little bit about the newcomers and things like that. But there's also, you know, there's the old stuff. There's the Liptons and Twinings and Tetleys and PG Tips and all those kinds of things. And there's a sort of a nostalgia aspect to it. Is this the same across the world? You know, in India and China, are there the huge brands that have always been there, or are people a little bit more particular and local and artisanal in their choices of tea?
Not to the same extent across the world. I think one of the reasons is, as a tea drinking nation that doesn't produce tea, we've grown up with blends, and blends and brands go hand in hand to an extent. You know, the earliest branding. Or some of the earliest brands were tea brands because they were a good way of helping consumers avoid adulteration. So those early brands over here, like Twinings and Tetley, you've got real assurance to the consumer that you are going to get the same thing you got last week, and it's not going to have Hawthorne in it because your name's on the pack. I think you see it in Europe as well. Brands like Douwe Egberts, Teekanne, Mesmer in Germany and Holland, they've been around for about as long as, or even longer than our brands have over here. You don't necessarily have the same compulsion in a tea producing country to have that, because you're more likely to be drinking a single origin tea, or it might be more readily available. So that although there are brands in China and India, they're perhaps not so rooted in history as our own ones are over here because of those historical factors. But I think the history of brands is really interesting, and how they've really helped cement in consumers' sort of lives a sense of trust in the product.
Mm. Now, you talked about adulteration. Now, this is an area that I find absolutely fascinating. What in the past has been added to tea to bulk it out or to con the buyer?
So we're talking long distant past, Stefan. I want to make sure any listeners know.
We're not talking about last week.
What happened today. But yeah, big one was Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. A lot of hedgerow.
Chippings,
all sorts of things that you might find in the garden. Some of them not a problem, some of them a bit risky. In the really long distant past, when we were getting tea out of China and consumers valued a very lurid green colour, then Prussian blue and gypsum, I think, was added. So you've got this very lurid green, eggy and rather poisonous character that was coming through. So yeah, there's been a few different attempts at adulteration, and I think that again that's another reason why brands are quite important. You know, also there's adulteration, or perhaps adulteration is the wrong word, but by necessity in the war in the Netherlands, there was, you know, need to find alternatives to tea, which still tasted a little bit of tea. And, you know, you still see that in coffee a little bit with chicory as well. So there's been all sorts of reasons why the what was inside the pack may not have exclusively been tea in the long distant past, but I think nowadays we're beyond that with that period.
Yeah. Okay, last couple of questions for you. Obviously a lot of our listeners are in the food and drink industry. What is the most exciting tea innovation that's out there? You talked about kombucha. Is there anything else that has really excited you and you've thought, I think they've got something going there?
Well, I'll tell you what I don't think the most exciting innovation is, and then we'll go on to I think tea is the simplest thing to prepare. in the world. And to my mind, one of the most exciting innovations at the moment is not tea or a new type of tea or a new preparation of it. It's the kitchen hot water tap. The instant boiling water has made tea so easy to enjoy. They nearly always have filters with them as well. So the ability just to go into your cupboard and make yourself something almost instantly with just the right amount of boiling water, that I think is really significant. And I think we overlook that at our peril. You know, every other week I might get a new notification on LinkedIn of a new device which sits on your counter and help you make your tea slightly more effectively. And you know, whilst I'm sure that they've got loads of merits, they're basically doing the same thing as a instant boiling water tap. And I think that the more we see those sort of things in the kitchen, the more it'll, I think, the easier it makes it for people to make tea and to enjoy it instantly and without having had to overboil a kettle or anything like that. So for me, that's probably not a very sexy answer, Stefan, but actually I think that sort of thing's quite important.
I think you're right. Yeah, it's the mechanics of making it. I mean, we have a boiling water tap here. And although it's really handy, I go back to what you said earlier, which is boiling the kettle is a moment of reflection and it's a pause in the day. And so I hate the hot water tap, but my wife won't let me have a kettle downstairs because she says, well, we've got a hot water tap. So it's but I think you're absolutely right. It's maybe not just the tea, it's the stuff around the tea that that offers lots of opportunities to people as well. Okay, and just the very last question, really. You obviously have a huge encyclopedic knowledge of tea. Is there a tea or a sort of a tea aspect from the past that you would resurrect? Something that isn't around today, but you think would be really, really good to revisit?
Perhaps the thing I would revisit is if you've ever been to Calcutta, and it is still around, but it's fallen out of fashion a bit. If you've been to Calcutta and had street tea, then it used to be served out of a really crudely fashioned clay cup, terracotta cup, that's unglazed. And when you drink the tea, you can still taste the clay dust on it. And it's... Yeah. But it's been made by someone locally, and you drink your tea, you just throw the cup on the street, it fills the potholes in the road up, and it gets ground back down to soil, and then the whole process can start again at some stage. I think that is the ultimate sustainable cup of tea, and I'd like to see more tea sold in sustainable packaging like that. I'd like to see more of that, a bit more of a thought to how it's served. And India is one of the largest consumers of tea and the second largest consumer country in the world. If more people drank their tea from terracotta cups, then we'd be a lot more sustainable in the packaging that we're...
Yeah. I mean, there is nothing worse. The worst cup of tea on the planet must be anything that's been put in a polystyrene cup. I don't know why, but it just ruins the experience.
Yes, exactly. And conversely, when you have that chai, when you've had enough of those street chais, I used to have them on my way to the office in Calcutta. There's one street in particular that makes them really well. That the taste of the clay is a real enhancement to the product.
And the tea's kind of boiled, isn't it? It seems like the worst, the milk is put in and it's boiled. And you kind of think this must be the worst way to make tea. And yet it is delicious.
Yeah, it works for that tea. And that's another factor, Stefan, really. You've got so many different preparation rituals around the world and they just work for the tea that they deploy. So if you go to Turkey and you have the Turkish tea preparation method, it works. It tastes lovely. You can sit in a cafe and have a baklava and a lovely cup of Turkish tea. It's beautiful. But if you try to take that tea back and make it over here in the UK, you wouldn't have the same experience. It's the same with the tea they use for the chai. It works in the way that it's deployed in that particular ritual, and that's one of the joys of tea, isn't it? It's versatility, and there's a different ritual for everyone.
Well, I think that's the perfect way to end this. Will Battle, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Stefan, very much for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. You can read Will's World Tea Encyclopedia, and there's so much to learn. It's almost like a history of the world. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, I want to introduce you to someone else from the Food Matters Live family. Elisa Roche is a podcast presenter, and she's going to be hosting a new series that's coming to the Table Talk podcast. It's called Career Conversations. Elisa, you're here with us. Tell us what the series is all about.
Hello, Stefan. So lovely to meet a fellow podcaster. I'm new to all this, and the new series is brand new as well. It's all about careers in and around the food and drinks industry, of which, as you know, there are so many.
That's so exciting. Yeah, and that, I mean, careers in the food industry could go from anything from somebody who's a writer in marketing to somebody who's actually designing production lines, isn't it? I mean, it covers sort of everything.
Exactly. So I'm hoping to hear from the obvious ones like chefs, which is where I started off, food writers, food stylists, food photographers, the kind of people you've spoken to before. But also I really want to hear from food scientists, people who are making new flavours and aromas, people who are making alternative meats from plant-based foods, all of that kind of stuff. The more the merrier.
Excellent. Now, this is your first podcast, but you've got loads of experience in the food sector, haven't you? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, I started off as a chef many years ago, longer than I care to remember. And Jamie Oliver was my first boss. He took me under his wing when I was a trainee chef doing my NVQs 1, 2 and 3 at Westminster Catering College. And then together with Jamie, all of us launched a restaurant in East London called 15. 15 was a charitable restaurant. And every 6 months, Jamie would take on six more young chefs and train them up into the industry. When I left Jamie, I went off into the industry myself and worked at some of London's top Michelin-starred kitchens. And eventually one day, completely out of the blue, I was approached by the Guardian newspaper to write a story for them about the life of a chef, and that launched me into journalism.
That's awesome. Now, with so many people to choose from, there must be thousands of guests that are sort of on your shortlist. Who's going to be the first guest?
I'm very excited about my first guest. Her name's Rhiannon Lambert. She's a nutritionist who started off life as really rather successful singer, classical singer, hanging out with Gary Barlow and Mylene Klass and lots of famous people. And then she became more and more interested in nutrition and studied very hard and is a very hard-working woman, as you'll hear when I interview her.
So do people need to do anything special to get the Career Conversations series?
No, you can find it on all the usual channels, but also if you already subscribe to the Table Talk podcast, you're going to get it there.
Excellent. Well, brilliant. Looking forward to it. Can't wait to listen to the first one.
Thanks, Stefan. I'll be listening to you for all my top tips.
Excellent. So you can follow us to get every episode of Table Talk freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.